Oh, hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where, depending on the day, we're trying to make today make sense, or none of us is as smart as all of us, or both.
It all depends on whatever branding fodder the producers put in front of us.
Could be anything.
Oh, my goodness.
Could be anything.
Let's see what they put up tomorrow. Okay, but tomorrow is tomorrow. Today is today, which is Wednesday. What do you want to know? Wednesday, as we call it around here. Your questions, our answers, and random thoughts as well. Let us begin.
Yes. Let's see. What do we got? We have got a voice memo from Alan in Florida.
Please explain the price spikes in the Texas energy crisis. Can spikes be capped for extreme weather events? Thanks. Love the show.
Oh, good question. Can they be spiked for extreme weather events? Yes.
Sure.
Will they in
if
Texas
you want
be
to.
Capped? No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about what you want your market to look like. And in Texas, they've decided they want an unregulated energy market, which is why people just got nailed.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened, we should say, to explain the price spikes, is that about 20 years ago, Texas deregulated its market and essentially said, you know, we're not going to make you buy energy from just one or a couple regulated utilities. We are going to create a competitive energy market where there are fewer regulations and all these companies can come along and you will definitely have cheaper prices because we won't be setting those prices. So about 60%, I think, of consumers in Texas are required to buy their electricity from one of these many retail power companies. And though many of them have this variable rate situation, which is when, you know, power is abundant, you pay lower prices in theory. And when power is scarce, as it was during these blackouts, you pay higher prices. And apparently, much like a short, you can have like infinite losses. Yeah. You can have an infinite power bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. I think the really interesting thing that's going to come out of this, look, I don't think you should expect the Texas energy market to get regulated because of what happened. But I think you're going to see a great hue and outcry from people about how these spikes have to be somehow ameliorated by government action. And we'll see whether there's like mandated forgiveness. We'll see if there's some kind of, I don't even know what, but it's, you know, there were people getting like five-figure power bills for like 3 days in the middle of this ice storm. And that just, it's, I don't know how that's going to keep going. And people keep getting elected down in Texas. I don't know.
Well, and not for nothing, but I have been obsessed with this story today in the Wall Street Journal about how that deregulated electricity market. And when they switched to it 20 years ago, they said, by God, if people aren't paying lower prices as a result of this, then we will have, quote, wasted our time and failed our constituency, said then State Senator David Sibley, a key author of the bill. The Wall Street Journal finds that, in fact, the people who are consumers of the deregulated Texas power, retail power companies, have paid more, $28 billion more for their power since 2004 than they would have paid at rates charged to the customers of the state's traditional utilities, because what often happens in deregulated markets is consolidation. We have seen that with airlines. We've seen it with cell phone providers. Yeah. And we've seen it with energy companies in Texas. There is less competition, no incentive really to create a great grid. And look, I'm sitting here with PG&E, so like I'm not going to cast all the aspersions on Texas's power market, let's be clear. But in terms of the core promise of this deregulation, which is that consumers would pay less, they haven't. They haven't.
Yep. Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Okay.
Okay. Our next question is from Parv down in Georgia.
I recently saw a statistic that said nearly half of all trades occur outside exchanges. What does that mean? Thanks.
Oh, yeah, good question.
We should probably go back and say, you mean stock trades and you mean stock exchanges. Let's fill in some nouns there.
Yes, fair enough. Fair enough. That's okay, a really good clarifying point. Okay, so you got your stock exchanges, the New York Stock Exchange being the most famous, right? But there's the NASDAQ and, you know, all the rest, right? Those are very heavily regulated. They are public. They are transparent. They are all of those things that ideally you want your financial markets to be, so you can get good price discovery and thus have clear-eyed decision-making about trades. Increasingly, and look, Robinhood is only one of the many off-exchange ways to trade, but it is the most well-known today. Increasingly, in this age of disintermediated information access and technology, you can trade stocks without actually going through an exchange. You don't have to go to a broker who then goes to the exchange, finds a seller for your stock or a buyer for your stock, depending on what you want to do, and then executes the trade in an open market, right? Robinhood routes its trades to a company and does those trades off the exchanges. And the challenge there, in addition to all the stuff with GameStop, which is not really related to it being off exchange, but the challenge there is that you don't have transparency. You don't have easy price discovery. You don't have solid and reliable allocation of capital. And that is really a challenge. And it's growing as people get onto apps and as younger people get in, as more individual investors want to trade. It's a thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And it's very interesting because the exchanges, at least with certainly with NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, they're for profit, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is a competitive, this is a huge competitive squeeze.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You betcha.
So, yes. So, when we talk about the disruption of something like Robinhood, that's what we mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Heaven help us. I can't believe we're going to do this. Let's talk about Bitcoin.
Okay, go.
We have been getting lots of questions about them, and here is an interesting one from Nick in Seattle.
So I recently learned that the energy usage of a single Bitcoin transaction is enough to power the average American home for nearly a whole week, and that globally, if Bitcoin was its own country, it'd be in the top 30 countries in terms of annual energy consumption. So the recent announcement of Tesla investing $1.5 billion into Bitcoin has me wondering how that affects their messaging that their cars are environmentally friendly. And more broadly speaking, how does cryptocurrency's energy consumption affect how we address climate change? Thank you so much. Love the show.
Yeah, so I know. This is a really interesting topic that is, like so many things, more complicated than it appears on its face. First of all, yes, Bitcoin has a carbon footprint. And I mean, everything does, obviously. I can already hear the emails. Everything has a carbon footprint. You have to be very precise when speaking of topics related to Bitcoin because the tweets are already being composed right now. The reason that Bitcoin uses a lot of energy is that in order to mine it, which is a cryptological process involving software and creating hashes and basically verifying transactions in larger and larger and larger numbers, it takes a lot of the mining takes a lot of computer power. Like, it used to be, you know, when Bitcoin was like new and there weren't that many that existed, there's a cap on how many can be created. Mm-hmm. And the more are being created, the more computing power it takes to basically run this very complicated math algorithm to check the accuracy of the whole thing. It used to be when my friends were like, I'm totally going to mine some Bitcoin, they would try to trick out the coolest gaming PC that they could come up with. And then they would notice that their power bills went way up. And then pretty soon it was like far, far, far beyond what you could do at your house. And now it's data centers. And so it uses a lot of energy. There is this kind of narrative that it is an unacceptable energy usage. The New York Times has reported that among the reasons Janet Yellen is skeptical of Bitcoin is this energy use. But there's also a lot of debate about it. And what fans of Bitcoin will say, which I think is probably true, is like, look, it one, because this is sort of a competitive marketplace, because you have to mine faster than the other person at all costs, they say that forces miners to seek out the lowest cost of power production that they can find. And so they're trying to, they're always striving to be more efficient, unlike the kind of physical money, right? Government funded system that we have for creating and distributing physical dollars and all of the infrastructure that goes into that, physical banks, trucks, driving money back and forth, right?
Yeah.
So there's kind of this huge hidden environmental cost of quote-unquote real money that doesn't exist with Bitcoin. And there's even like a whole conversation about how some miners are trying to figure out how to, you know, there's that flaring where they just flare off natural gas from power plants.
Natural gas.
And it's this like, it's like a massive polluter flaring. And so what some Bitcoin miners are trying to do is figure out how to redirect, like pipe some of that associated natural gas that otherwise would have been flared into like generators that are being used to generate, to mine Bitcoin. So they're like, actually, not only are we less of a physical infrastructure than real money, which is sometimes in the community referred to as cuck bucks, which cracks me up. That they're actually, you know, reducing flaring and taking pollution out of the air and redirecting it into mining operations. So it's more complicated that I think nobody has really been able to quantify it compared to the existing dollar infrastructure, let's say.
Right. Dollar infrastructure is real, right? And it's huge. And that has to be part of the calculation. So two things. Number one, did we decide we're doing a Bitcoin Tuesday episode? Have we decided that yet?
Friends of the show, we have been discussing doing a Bitcoin Tuesday episode. What do you think? Tell us what you'd like to hear.
What do you want to know about Bitcoin, actually?
What do you want to know about Bitcoin? You tell us, and then we'll make a show around it. Look at us.
Okay. I've got another crypto-y, blockchain-y kind of thing that I'm kind of intrigued by, but don't completely understand. And I don't really, I'm not asking you for a considered response on this one, but I'd love your thoughts on these things called non-fungible tokens. Should we
this
not
is
even
like
go
one
there?
Of those things,
is that like too hard?
I think it's like one of those things that I totally read about. And
they're like video clips based on the blockchain of like the NBA is selling NFTs, non-fungible tokens. Artists are selling non-fungible tokens of their own art. So it's like a collectible that is on the blockchain that only belongs to you when you own it. And it's just kind of wild. All right. Well, look, if we do Bitcoin, I'm going to do a little special addendum on NFTs. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And they're not interoperable because they're non-fungible. So they only exist for the thing that you created it for, kind of.
Right. So, you know, you buy a baseball card and there could be 15, you know, Babe Ruth baseball cards out there. But there's only one video clip of LeBron James in the game against the Orlando Magic where he does that. Yeah, where he does that thing. And they take that clip, they put it on the blockchain somehow. And it's non-fungible because you can't trade it for anything else. I mean, you can trade it, I imagine, but it's not exchangeable with anything else, right? It's just, that's it. That's the one. Anyway.
So it seems like it's mostly used for authenticity and ownership. This is fascinating.
Yes.
Look at you.
Right.
All right.
I know.
See, now we're going to, I think we should change this up. I'm just going to go ahead and produce this show on the fly. We should change up our model and sort of, because we could have like a conversation where it's like this or that, but it would be great to just be like, okay, here are the top 10 questions that we have.
Yeah.
Let's put them in order of some sort of narrative arc and just ask them one at a time, like a lightning round with a really smart person.
Ready to go. Ready to go.
Anyway. Okay. I'm into it.
All right. Okay. Do we have one more? Is there one more coming? Yes, there is. I think there's one more. We got a couple of minutes.
Yes.
Grady's in London. Ready to begin.
Are you half full or half empty on a Stonktail recipe book for the next fundraising campaign?
Where is Stephanie Patterson?
I didn't even know I was half full on that until I got so half full on that. What a great idea. It could be a slim volume.
Has to write the preface. Yeah.
I mean, she totally does. Yeah. And she's already taken all the incredible photos.
I know.
Of at least
food
like
stylist.
A bunch of the, oh my goodness.
Of a drink stylist, actually.
We'll email our people about this because we love it. It's a great idea.
We'll have our people get back
to it. It's a great idea.
People.
We mean our one person, pretty much.
Oh, man.
I love
it. Okay.
Love it.
There we
are. Okay,
end
cool.
of the day.
That's it.
On What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? I know. Back tomorrow is what we're going to be. Keep sending your questions and your comments. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Emails are good. Voice memos are better. I don't know.
I like
sometimes
it. I like it. Just a little.
Sometimes I am just blathering.
Voice crack of a song. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera, who I'm told had exactly the same idea about a Bitcoin episode, an explain-a-thon, which is amazing. Tony Wagner is our digital producer, meaning he'll translate all the blather into a website. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and smart speaker skills.
Charlton Thorpe was in actual control of this podcast today. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Hey, has anybody heard from Bridget lately, by the way? Just to, you know.
I got a couple of cute pictures the other day.
Okay.
It's like she psychically sensed I needed it.
There you go. Baby pics.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.